The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
When I say system, of course, it's something different from the state. So the illusion at the time among people, and I belong to the to those people at the time, was that, communism would go away pretty much like in, Czechoslovakia, East Germany, Poland. But we would still live in the same state. So very few people paid very close attention to ethnic separatism, Baltic bit of independence, and would say, oh, it's not only the Balts. If the Balts go, then it would be, a falling domino effect. And of course, very few people, I repeat, understood the implications of the Russian drive for sovereignty and declaration of sovereignty. So people inside the Soviet Union, particularly in Moscow, where the center of action always was during those times, they continued to shake things in expectation that, one more push and the rotten communist system would fall apart. But they never expected that with the system, the state itself would fall apart.
I'm Bryce Clem, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 27th, 2021. This past weekend marked the 30th anniversary of the collapse of the Soviet Union. To discuss the collapse and its implications, I sat down with Vladislav Zubok, professor of international history at the London School of Economics and author of the new book, Collapse, The Fall of the Soviet Union. We covered a range of topics, including Mikhail Gorbachev's economic and political reforms, Professor Zubok's experience reading Solzhenitsyn for the first time, and the Russian military's recent buildup along Ukraine's borders. It's the Lawfare Podcast, December 27th, The Fall of the Soviet Union with Vladislav Zubok. So why did you write this book?
Well, I was born in the Soviet Union and grew up there. So when I was around 30 or so, Gorbachev started reforms and perestroika, and I participated in what can be called a democratic movement, where people for the first time in their lives discussed things freely. So people around me were full of hopes. So when things began to go wrong, and in just a few years the Soviet Union collapsed, it was a huge shock for many people, and people related it to diverse causes, including democratization. So people began to relate democracy to chaos and destruction of the state. So, and foreign influences, such as Western influences. So at some point, I began to search for an answer why exactly the Soviet Union, that had all kinds of structural problems, economic and so on and so forth, why nevertheless it collapsed so suddenly and so quickly. So it was not a question why the Soviet Union collapsed, it was why it collapsed so suddenly and rapidly and thoroughly. And I couldn't find any answer in the existing literature. And since I teach students, every time students ask me, Professor, can you explain that the same country that withstood the onslaught of Wehrmacht during World War II collapsed so suddenly without any war or any evident pressure? I had no clear answer to this, and I decided to write this book to explain it to myself and to my students.
So I'm curious, what new sources, if any, did you have access to, and how did that help you sort of form your arguments?
There are more sources than you can imagine. That was the period when everyone discussed things freely and openly, and that is in a public domain. Plus, there are electronic archives, which helped me during the time of COVID and self-isolation. There are just thousands and thousands of documents and oral histories, audio interviews, even newsreels of all sorts collected in several useful archives. Plus, on the Western side, I used a lot the documents from the Bush Presidential Library. They, for instance, released all conversations with Gorbachev and Yeltsin and other leaders at that time related to the Soviet Union. So I used that widely. And my preference was, given the abundance of sources, my preference was not to memoirs, when people, after all, recall later what happened, but to the documents of first class, of primary nature. So when people, for instance, discussed something at the time, in 1990, 1991, and my task was not to explain fully why people acted in this or that way. It's nearly impossible with the revolutionary events like this. But how did people feel? In what sense they were surprised by what was happening? So in my book, I sort of try to restore the atmospherics of the time, because I remember myself rather clearly 31, 32 years ago, when I was much younger and I was full of ideals and ideas. How did it feel at the time, and to what extent it contributed to the outcome?
Let's jump into the book and some of the narratives that you push back against. I think it's a pretty common refrain in the West, at least, that, oh, the collapse of the Soviet Union was completely inevitable. Gorbachev, when he came to power, he was handed a failing system and there was nothing he could really do, and it sort of unraveled. And you really push back against that. I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Yes, I do. I do, because I found it strange that the same people who could not predict such a rapid unraveling of the Soviet system and even the Soviet state quickly assumed that what happened was inevitable. And the sense that the word inevitability, in my view, should not be applied to history at all. This is the way we try to teach our students. Nothing is inevitable. It's all the combination of structural factors and human agency and various contingencies, like, for instance, the Chernobyl disaster happened, nobody expected it, lots of casualties. How did it affect the situation? So I write about it. And, what I found already in the process of collecting my material and writing the book, that all those things that were cited by a number of authors as an indisputable cause for the Soviet collapse, such as the burden of the arms race against the United States, the anti-alcohol campaign by Gorbachev that cost budget a lot of money, the Chernobyl disaster, the falling oil prices, the war in Afghanistan, a number of other issues, all that taken together did not really overtax the Soviet budget and did not destabilize the Soviet financial and economic system. And I was surprised, why people keep repeating these factors as something self-evident, and then they dismiss the discussion about the Soviet collapse. It looks like people don't want to reopen this issue and go back. And more surprisingly, it concerns my countrymen, the Russians, who of course assume that was bygone. They didn't want to go back to that traumatic event of 1991. They prefer to go beyond it and discuss what happened there after that. So that's more like, psychological, cognitive factors. But nevertheless, I decided, I should stick with it. I should address this issue in a really focused way and come up with my new paradigm. And my new paradigm essentially is that without Gorbachev's reforms and the way they destabilized the system, particularly economic and financial system, nothing like what we saw in 1989, 91 would have been possible. The Soviet Union would have existed for years and years.
So that's a perfect segue. Let's talk about Gorbachev, the man. What was his ideology? I mean, you refer to him repeatedly in the book as a neo-Leninist. So for the non-Soviet experts, what do you mean by that?
Well, Lenin was somebody that had been considered almost a secular deity at the time when Gorbachev grew up. Even at the time when I grew up, I'm much younger. We were taught that Lenin was the founder of the Soviet state. Lenin was an ideal figure, was a revolutionary. He wanted justice for everyone. He started anti-colonial struggle around the world and all those good things. What we were not told was that Lenin, you know, created a dictatorship, used violence, instigated mass killing. And he was a true teacher of Stalin in many ways. So for Gorbachev, who was, after all, a student of the late 40s and early 50s, when Stalin was alive, then Stalin died, Gorbachev was at the Moscow State University. For Gorbachev, it was kind of, you know, an adopted binary of sorts, good Lenin, bad Stalin. He didn't look beyond that sort of social socialist dualism with a good leader that had founded the state and the bad leader that took things, you know, astray. So I think he continued to revolve within this dual kind of, you know, paradigm throughout the 70s and even the 80s, to my surprise. What surprised me and why it surprised me, you know, when I was young, I even read Lenin and tried to understand what went wrong. And then at some point, that was in the 70s, I realized that all this just, you know, a failed ideology, and you wouldn't find any answers in this, you know, reading Lenin, only basically discovering that Lenin was even worse than Stalin in some ways. What surprised me that Gorbachev never drew this conclusion. And even when he read such authors as Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who was an ardent anti-communist, even that did not push him to abandon the ideals of socialism. He only basically decided, okay, if Lenin is not as good as I imagined, I would accomplish this task of transforming socialism into a socialism with a human face. So I think this is what he tried to do. He continued to read Lenin in 1989-90 in search of various clues. He couldn't find those clues, for instance, what to do with nationalities, what to do with economy. In fact, what he found in Lenin were all wrong and even disastrous answers to the predicament that the Soviet Union was in. So I think it's a paucity of usable past, the paucity of Gorbachev not being able to reach out and find something useful for him. What he found was, on the contrary, very harmful for his reforms. And of course, he was not alone. He was surrounded by people who had belonged to his cohort of people who grew up in the 50s and the 60s. You know, it would have been much better if he had relied on much younger people, probably.
Before we jump into his reforms and what he actually did, you mentioned something interesting there, that he read Solzhenitsyn. And one thing that really struck me in the book was how you describe how he was sort of an academic while he was in charge. And I was wondering if you could talk about his management style a little bit, or lack of a management style that he had. And also, it really surprised me that he read sort of forbidden literature while he was in charge. That came to me as a surprise.
Well, it didn't come to me as a surprise, because there was a special printing section inside the party that printed a limited number of so-called forbidden books and texts for the party functionaries, who could take them home. And even I, at some point in Moscow, you know, my classmates invited me to his house, and I found their Solzhenitsyn on the shelf. I was in complete shock. And then he said, oh, my father works for the Central Committee apparatus of the party. So, you know, here we are. So instead of drinking vodka and chatting with girls, I took one of Solzhenitsyn's volume and began to devour it. It just tells you how strange life was in those days. So that is not a surprise. What is surprising, again, it's Gorbachev, who had been sort of cast back to provinces after graduating from the Moscow State University. And he found himself among those, you know, crass middle-level apparatchiks who had no intellectual pursuits at all, no ethics at all. And for him, he felt like, you know, being cast away on an island. And his wife, of course, was also graduate of Moscow State University, Raisa. And two of them cultivated an intellectual lifestyle. So they decided, we will not be consumed by all this provincial morass. We will educate ourselves. We will read books, sociology, political science, philosophers, and things like that. So Gorbachev, in fact, under the influence of his wife, who was a sociologist and philosopher, he sort of became like a little bit of philosophical himself, maybe too philosophical for a practical leader of such a complex country as the Soviet Union. So I discovered time and again, when there was a time of decision, it doesn't mean he could make a decision. He made pretty tough decisions in 1987-88. But then something happened when he sort of grew out of predictable solutions. He didn't know what to do, and he continued to discuss them with all kinds of people. He continued to theorize about those issues and remained sort of paralyzed on a practical level. He just couldn't make any practical decisions. He had to find the right theoretical explanation to them. So that's kind of a bizarre problem that they hobbled him since, I would say, early 1989.
So let's talk about some of those economic reforms of Perestroika 87, 88. I was wondering if you could just sort of give a brief overview of those for our listeners who haven't been studying this recently.
Well, you know, that's a problem. I tried myself to understand what was happening, and my economic education was not sufficient to understand it. And I got some help from economists, and there are very few economists who actually can comment on Soviet type of economy. It was such an unusual type of economy. We know only cliches. Well, central planning, there was constant deficit, they couldn't buy even a toilet paper without standing in queues, and all those cliches, which in part were true, but it didn't explain how the system worked. And economists who worked inside the Soviet system and analyzed it explained to me that, you know, it was indeed a centralized system based on very curious idea of management and financial management, especially. For instance, you know, it was highly integrated. So the chain of supply and, and production was like, you know, all country web, tying together all the republics, all the regions. So it was impossible to disentangle it. So when national separatism began to threaten that system, that above all threatened the wholesomeness of Soviet economy. There literally could be, you know, one little factory in somewhere in Armenia that produced necessary details for giant plants and factories all across Ukraine and Russia. So let's say this one factory was affected by an ethnic strife and would shut down. That would affect the entire economy in a sense. But even more, I was surprised to discover the importance of money. I mean, growing up in the Soviet Union, we were sort of taught that money is not so important. It's important to be an educated person and work hard and all that for your socialist motherland. But, you know, accumulation of money is wrong, morally wrong. Speculation is wrong. And all these things. So to my surprise, I discovered that Soviet financial system was rather well thought through and, of course, adjusted to the idea of socialism, I would say. Most of enterprises, socialist enterprises, which is what, you know, Western corporations probably would be, they operated on cashless principle. In other words, there were virtual money that could not be transferred into cash. Sort of like a cryptocurrency of sorts that could never be turned into cash. Moreover, it was forbidden to turn this virtual currency into cash because cash was used only for small transactions for paying salaries and wages to people. And that was done to control inflation. And that worked pretty well. Of course, there was inflation, but even during the worst time of the Second World War, the Soviet finances did not collapse like they could have collapsed in any, you know, in market economy. And what is interesting, that Gorbachev's reforms opened significant holes in this divide between cashless economy and economy based on cash, that is economy of consumption. And that the whole was kind of predictable. What was surprising that a number of economists pointed to Gorbachev and the head of the government, Ryzhkov. Wait a minute, it's basically like, you know, you're in Titanic and you just punctured several important partitions in Titanic, and so the whole ship can submerge very quickly. And they don't listen. Gorbachev probably did not listen because he couldn't comprehend that system, that financial system. It is kind of, you know, counterintuitive, even for well-prepared people. So indeed, the Soviet economy got several holes. You know, I mentioned Chernobyl, I mentioned anti-alcohol campaign. But the biggest hole was the authorization to state enterprises to keep profits and turn it into cash and engage in foreign trade beyond the state control, and also turn your profit into cash. And that kind of flood of cash without appropriate partitions inside the Soviet financial system, this is what made the Soviet ship capsize in the end.
So at the same time that he's undergoing those economic reforms, you also describe the political reforms. Now, presumably this is something, having been trained, having had a legal education that Gorbachev had, he would have understood sort of what he was doing. What were some of his governance reforms, and how did those alienate sort of the party elite, the nomenklatura?
Well, you just mentioned the republics, and I should, before I speak about political reforms, I should mention the fact that there were 15 republics in the Soviet Union, and constitutionally, those republics had the right of exit from the Union, and they were solemnly claimed to be sovereign. Of course, no one took that sovereignty literally, and nobody took constitution literally. So when Gorbachev announced that there would be the political liberalization, political reforms, and he started it with all kinds of Leninist slogans, all power to the Soviets, we should give back the real autonomy and powers to the republics. And it was sort of like back to Leninist proclaimed ideals that Lenin never meant to follow in the early days of the Soviet Union. Lenin was all for the proletarian dictatorship, that is the party dictatorship, covered by all kinds of slogans. Gorbachev took those slogans literally and began to implement them. So indeed, in the essence, his political reforms began to devolve more and more authority to the republics, at least in public rhetoric. And this slogan, neo-Leninist slogan, idealistic slogan of power to the republics, and in part it was dictated by, you know, taking the Soviet constitution seriously and taking it literally, because it did promise the rights of republic to do all kinds of things. And Gorbachev would complain to the Politburo and to his friends, oh, well, Stalin reduced what was conceived under Lenin as a confederation or federation to a unitary state. And that was, you know, we now should take it back to federation, you know, to have real, real harmony between national republics and the center. And, he acted on it and quickly realized he was, you know, treading on the minefield, because the first what happened that the bolts who had been annexed in 1940 as a result of the Nazi-Soviet pact, they realized, aha, Gorbachev is heading in this direction. We'll take advantage of it. But the real goal of the Baltic nationalists, and you know, even some communists who posed as communists, was to take the Baltic republics out of the Soviet Union. And for a while, Gorbachev sort of, you know, didn't want to admit it fully, because it would have meant that his whole approach to the Soviet Union was a failure. It was based on illusions, not reality. So then, of course, he faced a major calamity and surprise in the form of the Russian separatism, because when, as a result of Gorbachev's freedoms and free elections of March 1990, the new Supreme Soviet of the Russian Federation was elected and convened in Moscow. It immediately adopted, almost unanimously, the Declaration of Russian Sovereignty. And this declaration, in a sense, was the beginning of the end of the Soviet Union, because Russia was a core republic. In fact, you know, it was never meant to be even autonomous, because it was the core, the basis on which the Soviet statehood or what a Soviet economy rested. So this strange phenomenon of Russian separatism, I would even call it Rexit after Brexit, cannot be fully explained. For Westerners, for instance, it was a nonsense. They always assumed that the Soviet Union was a bigger Russia of sorts. And for Russians themselves, who voted for sovereignty, they never imagined that this somehow could lead to the collapse of the entire state in the Soviet Union. It's a classic case of the revolutionary period, when people do something, even when they think about it, they don't think that it would lead to such far-reaching consequences. And Gorbachev, again, in this case, was faced with a new political reality, and he refused to think it through to the end. Essentially, the only way after that was, I don't know, somehow to assume strong authoritarian presidency. And in March 1990, Gorbachev was elected the president of the Soviet Union. He was both the general secretary of the Communist Party and the president of the Soviet Union. And he was given, granted by, you know, the Congress of the USSR, all kinds of highly dictatorial powers for emergency. But he never used those powers. He was not interested in and didn't know what to do with executive powers, because, you know, frankly, to use executive powers at this revolutionary stage, when everything became disbalanced and disputed, ran a high risk of bloodshed and using force. And Gorbachev was a principled opponent to any use of force inside the country. I mean, we have a remarkable phenomenon of a head of the party, the head of the Soviet Union, you know, the party and the state that had been the children of blood and iron, sort of the children of terror, all of a sudden renouncing all this terror and even the use of violence. And he even refused to use violence to preserve the common state. This is highly unusual. Even leaders of other states, of course, more democratic, you may say, always use force when they're confronted with disastrous separatism that threatens their statehood. And Gorbachev refused to do it.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Could your political views make you the target of cybercrime, identity theft, stalking, or even violence? I used to think this was silly, and then weird things started happening to me. Someone defaced my car. It had Lawfare license plates on it. Somebody delivered weird antique postcards of Guantanamo Bay to my house. You know, weird stuff. The volume of personal data online has tripled between 2019 and 2023, and angry individuals fueled by political polarization can access it all for up to 98% of American citizens. And I was one of them. Lots of people were using my name, my home address, other information about me to try to intimidate me. And I want to say that has dramatically slowed down in recent months. And one of the reasons is Delete Me. As I have said before, there are products here that I read the ads because, you know, that's my job. And there are products here that I read the ads because I really use them and really like them. And Delete Me is one of the Lawfare advertisers that I am most enthusiastic about. And here's why. It finds and removes personal information I don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from all of the largest search databases on the web. And in the process, it helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. And here's the important point. It doesn't just do it once, because the information will get back into the systems. It does it, and then it does it again. So the first time I got one of these reports, and they send regular reports at DeleteMe, you know, there were a whole bunch of systems that I'd come off of. But then each time I get one now, there's still one or two or three that I'm back on the system and DeleteMe has once again deleted me. So sign up and provide DeleteMe with exactly what information you want deleted, and their experts will take it from there. And as I say, they send regular personalized privacy reports showing what info they have found, where they found it, and what they removed. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. When you sign up, they immediately go to work scrubbing all your personal information from data broker platforms. Your personal profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for DeleteMe now at a special discount for Lawfare listeners. Today, get 20% off your DeleteMe plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use the promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code Lawfare 20.
So let's rewind a little bit and move to more of the international arena. During the section of the book where you talk about the collapse of the Berlin Wall, you quote William Taubman, the biographer of Gorbachev, who said that after the collapse of the wall, Gorbachev really started reacting to change as opposed to initiating change. I'm paraphrasing here. I was wondering if you could sort of explain that concept and how Gorbachev came to view the collapse of the wall.
The wall was important, but of course it was symbolically important above all. It wasn't that important in the story of the Soviet collapse. What happened, however, that the focus of world news shifted dramatically and irrevocably from what was happening in Moscow under Gorbachev to what was happening in Germany and Eastern Europe. So suddenly the Soviet Union was out of focus of world media. And it never returned to that focus, I would say, until August 1991, when all of a sudden there were tanks in Moscow, you know, a coup, and then you know, all journalists of the world, including CNN, refocused on what was in the Soviet Union. And meanwhile, between November 89, when the wall fell, and August 1991, a lot of things went down the bridge in the Soviet Union. Huge changes that essentially went by wayside for most of the rest of the world. So now my argument is not only that Gorbachev lost initiative, and he did. I think I would argue he lost initiative even before the fall of the wall, because he sort of started his reforms in March, April 1989. And by the summer of 89, he faced the consequences that he didn't expect, and he did not know what to do with those consequences. Workers' strikes, the Baltic independence bid, you know, all kinds of other stuff, economic and financial decline. He already basically had no strategy for those consequences. But after November 89, he even, you know, stopped to be the main driver of change in Europe. You know, that his role became different. He sort of began to be viewed by the West as the person who sort of presides over a hopefully peaceful decline of the empire. And, you know, of course, in November 1990, he received the Nobel Prize for Peace for basically condoning with the reunification of Germany, despite 500,000 of Soviet troops in East Germany. So that was his new role. He was no longer the demiurge and, you know, driver of change. He was the driver of, let's say, peaceful decline and collapse of the state he presided over.
Now, many of the analysts, though, at that time, I don't think we should, you know, they didn't necessarily think that the end of the empire meant the end of the Soviet state. Would you say that's accurate? In Moscow, they thought, okay, they can withdraw from Eastern Europe, but the Soviet state will still be around.
Yes. And during 1990, and I would say until the spring of 1991, practically no one, and by practically no one, I mean, you know, observers in the mainstream media, intelligence services, analysts in Western governments, and even inside the Soviet Union, believed that there was an automatic kind of linkage between the fall of communism in Eastern Europe and inevitable collapse of the Soviet state. But I remember very clearly that there was a connection between the fall of communist systems in Eastern Europe and communist systems in the Soviet Union. When I say system, of course, it's something different from the state. So the illusion at the time among people, and I belong to the to those people at the time, was that, okay, communism would go away pretty much like in, I don't know, Czechoslovakia, East Germany, Poland. But, you know, we would still live in the same state. So very few people paid very close attention to ethnic separatism, Baltic bit of independence, and would say, oh, it's not only the Balts. If the Balts go, then it would be, you know, a falling domino effect. And of course, very few people, I repeat, understood the implications of the Russian drive for sovereignty and declaration of sovereignty. So people inside the Soviet Union, particularly in Moscow, where the center of action always was during those times, they continued to shake things in expectation that, you know, one more push and the rotten communist system would fall apart, but they never expected that with the system, the state itself would fall apart. And this is a cognitive blindness that I distinctly remember. And in my interviews, when I was collecting evidence for the book, I raised this question with many people, particularly the Russians. And they said, oh, no, we never thought about it. We never could imagine it.
Let's move to really briefly to the relationship that Gorbachev had with the Bush administration. I was wondering if you could talk about the grand bargain that was proposed and why the Bush administration pretty much ultimately rejected it.
Well, the grand bargain was the idea of, I would say, a few economic and political entrepreneurs. It didn't come from government structures. It came from one young Soviet economist, Grigory Yavlinsky, who began to talk about shock therapy and IMF-approved reforms in the Soviet Union and, you know, liberation of prices, for instance, and leap to the market, and argued that to make it politically acceptable, you know, everybody knew that such things could lead to real social tension, you know, and that method was used in various countries of Latin America and produced military dictatorships there. And in Chile, of course, Pinochet most famously carried out those reforms. So Yablinsky said, you know, if we want both a leap to the market and somehow a movement, evolution towards democracy and not back to authoritarianism, we need some kind of cushion. We need, you know, sort of a reserve of foreign currency, preferably dollars, that would mitigate social consequences of price liberalization and inflation. So he found some people in Washington and at Harvard that supported him. Graham Allison was very much moved by that grandiose task of bringing the Soviet economy to market and to democracy. So he supported Yavlinsky, and they came up with this idea that was called grand bargain. And grand bargain because, you know, that was a real bargain for Americans to give, I don't know, like, you know, $150 billion to the former enemy to turn it into friend. And it would be much less than otherwise the United States would have to spend if the Soviet Union goes back to bad ways and the Cold War would resume and so on and so forth. So grand bargain. The Bush administration immediately rejected that plan. And in the evidence that I could find on the discussions of White House, they never believed that Congress would authorize this money. Because essentially, American polity continued to treat the Soviet Union as an enemy, even despite the fact that publicly it was declared that the Cold War was over. But American polity lived much more under the inertia of the Cold War than the Soviet elites and Soviet public. Essentially, in the Soviet Union, November 89 was the time when Gorbachev declared the Cold War is over after the summit of Malta. And even the military industrial complex sort of complied with it and began to reach out to the former enemy. One of my discoveries was how eager was the Soviet military industrial complex to cooperate with the American military industrial corporations. So the Bush administration discussed it, realized that Congress would never allocate the money. Moreover, the Bush administration itself thought that all this money would be wasted because Gorbachev had no viable program. But there was another underlining reason that I found in the documents. The reason was why we should help the Soviet Union and the Soviet economy and finances to tide over during those difficult days. After all, we are not interested in the Soviet Union to remain a superpower at all. Some members of the administration spoke very clearly. Our interest is to turn the Soviet Union or Russia into a third-rate power, unable to have a big military capacity that can threaten the United States and the world and so on and so forth. So the idea was we should not help them to remain a superpower. We should wait until they would continue destroying themselves. We should only be interested in keeping this process peaceful and take care of nuclear weapons.
So we're skipping over a lot here because we have a limited time with you. We're skipping over the rise of Yeltsin and everything, but the book is full of so much detail. And I was wondering if you could just talk to us about Gorbachev's resignation speech, which was on December 25th, 1991. And you give some great detail about the speech in his book. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that moment and what it meant for you being from the Soviet Union.
Well, I don't actually remember that moment 30 years ago, because by that time it was clear to everyone that the Soviet Union was finished. It was finished de jure and de facto. And on December 8th, the leaders of three so-called Slavic republics, the Russian Federation, Ukraine, and Belarus, met very close to the Polish border and declared the Soviet Union as null and void, as the object of, as geopolitical reality and juridical subject. By the time Gorbachev gave his speech, everyone not only gave up on the Soviet Union, there was no protest, by the way, no open signs of discontent let me explain this a little bit for the listeners, why nobody spoke up or marched to preserve the Soviet Union. I think many people by that time became so befuddled and confused by all these changes of political landscape and so consumed by everyday economic misery and the search for goods, basic goods, that they didn't even pay attention how the name of the country changed. So when the leaders of the three republics declared, oh, this USSR is over, from now on, there will be the Commonwealth of Independent States. And people essentially shrugged it off. Okay, another name for the country, assuming that the country would stay together. So there was this illusion, particularly among the Russians, but not only the Russians. Second factor was that Gorbachev undermined his popularity by that time so thoroughly that he became an irrelevant figure. He lost his power after the August coup. Yeltsin seized it. Gorbachev continued to play a role of a sort of a persuader, trying to convince the chiefs of all these republics to come together and save the common country, talking to them like a solicitor almost, or insurance agent. Okay, if you go to different places, it will be catastrophe for all of you. And, he ended up becoming totally irrelevant to such an extent, I would argue, that the army no longer listened to him. They followed Yeltsin, who, after all, gave them salaries from the budget of the Russian Federation. The KGB was so demoralized that it was out of picture for a while. Police, the same thing. And the money printing press was in Yeltsin's hand by that time, so Gorbachev didn't have any control of money. What remains of Gorbachev is his title of President of the USSR and this so-called nuclear button. And the most poignant detail that I discovered that, you know, this so-called, you know, nuclear suitcase that was in sort of in the hands of the commander-in-chief, which in theory, Gorbachev still was until his resignation, that suitcase was probably already disconnected. So, you know, that ceremony of Gorbachev's resignation and his subsequent passing of this nuclear suitcase to, you know, the Minister of Defense of I don't know what, the Soviet Union or Commonwealth of Independent States by that moment, it was already a piece of ceremony that had nothing to do with the real transfer of nuclear power.
So I have just one last question for you. While I have you here, I have to ask you about the buildup of troops along the border of Ukraine. And I'm just wondering, as a Cold War historian and a historian of the Soviet Union, a lot of people say, at least in the Western media, that, oh, Putin just wants to rebuild the empire. And I'd just like to get your thoughts on that.
I may say something highly unpopular, but I don't believe in a moment that Putin wants to restore the Soviet Union. He said in the earlier days of his presidency that those people who want to restore the Soviet Union have no brains, and I think he sticks with this maxim to this day. Of course, the regime became more authoritarian and did all kinds of provocative things and statements, and people refer to that usually saying that, you know, the regime became completely untrustworthy and unpredictable. But the situation with Ukraine has a long story, and it goes back exactly to the collapse of the Soviet Union when Yeltsin and the first president of Kravchuk signed a number of treaties to form the Commonwealth of Independent States. But pretty much immediately, the issue of Crimea blew up, the issue of Donbass. And there was this feeling that the Commonwealth, so-called Commonwealth, would ran aground on the basis of tension between Ukraine and the Russian Federation. What Yeltsin hoped that Russia would stay dominant, that Ukraine was so dependent economically in terms of oil supplies, in terms of culture, you know, and even ethnic mixed population on Russia, that you know, Ukrainian independence would be impossible. So that situation was already bad enough, and pregnant with various conflicts. And even at the time, in November, in December 1991, quite openly in the press, in Moscow and Kiev, one could read about war scenarios. And even in nuclear Yugoslavia, you know, Yugoslavia was falling apart at the time, so they spoke that Ukrainian-Russian war could even go nuclear at the time. And that is without any NATO, without any NATO enlargement. But NATO's plans, when in 1997, Yeltsin and Clinton talked about NATO enlargement, Yeltsin said in no-nonsense terms, listen, Bill, we will not tolerate the expansion of NATO into the former Soviet republics, particularly to Ukraine. So when in 2008 in Bucharest, Bush Jr. made this very provocative remark that NATO is open to membership of Ukraine and Georgia, for Putin it was a red line, and it was a very bad signal. And I would say that without it, probably we would not have had what we're having now, including troop concentrations. What it amounted to, at least as I understand Putin's reasoning, people may say I understand Putin too much. It's no longer fashionable, but I will say it. From Putin's perspective, NATO refuses to give Russia any voice in the process of changing European security architecture. So the United States clearly plays the first fiddle in this process, but Russia is denied any voice in it. So what kind of voice Russia can have, by making the West and primarily the United States listen. And how to do it if the West refuses to listen? By moving troops to the border. And this is what they do. So it's highly provocative and dangerous. And I really hope that it will not lead to a real military clash.
All right. We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for asking such intelligent question.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please share the Lawfare Podcast and give us a 5-star review on iTunes. Go to thelawfarestore.com for brand new Lawfare pens, lanyards, and t-shirts. The podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patia Howell, and your audio engineer is Ian Enright of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.